third block was across a wide alley south on the same side of the street as Perino. There, in the courtyard they'd sought shelter in earlier, Captain Steele and three Delta teams were still stuck, unable to push further down toward the wreck. This ungainly distribution of forces was problematic. The Little Bird pilots, who were making frequent gun runs, were having a hard time clearly delineating friendly force locations from targets. From the C-2 Black Hawk high above, Lieutenant Colonel Harrell radioed a request to Captain Miller.
"Scotty, is it possible for you to get everybody in one small, tight perimeter? The problem we have is everyone is spread out. It's hard to get close, accurate fire into you. And mark your location. We need to know exactly where you are. Is there any way you can accomplish that? Over."
Miller explained that Steele seemed reluctant to move up, and that the Delta teams with Steele were also pinned down by heavy fire.
"Roger, I know it's tough, and you're doing the best you can, but try to get everyone at one site, and have one guy talking down there if you can."
Miller conveyed the request to the team leaders cornered with Steele. Then, just before dark, he ordered Sergeant Howe to move across Marahan Road and into the courtyard opposite in order to improve their coverage of the street. Howe thought it was a poor idea. It did nothing he could see to improve their position. He'd been out on the street for long periods earlier and had a plan of his own. Steele and the others stranded at the southernmost tip of this awkward perimeter should move up and consolidate with them. This would shorten the long leg of the L, give them a single strong position to hold, and give the Little Birds a clearly defined one-block area to work around. They could then establish strong interlocking fire positions at each of the key intersections, both in front of and behind the downed bird, and at the south end of the block. Looking around outside, Howe had seen three buildings that could be taken down and occupied, which would have expanded their fire perimeter. A two-story house at the northwest corner of the intersection, off the bird's tail, would have provided a shooting platform that could push the Somali gunmen to the north several blocks further out. Howe felt this was so obviously the way to go, it surprised him that the ground commanders hadn't begun it already. Instead, as Howe saw it, they seemed overwhelmed. They had followed him into the courtyard and then squatted there, just as Steele was now squatting in a worthless position off to the south. Everything in Howe's training said that survival depended on proactive soldiering. You constantly assessed your position and worked to improve it. Howe knew there was no point arguing. He and the three men on his team ran across the road in groups of two. They barged through the front door of a two-room house and cleared it. There was no one inside. Through a barred window in back, Howe saw Perino and his group. One of Howe's team members knocked out the bars and just pushed down the flimsy stone wall to open up a passage into their space. Perino and Schmid strapped the dying Corporal Smith to a board and passed him through the window into the room. There they would be sheltered from grenades lobbed over the walls. As far as Howe was concerned, his position sucked. From the doorway he could see only the corners of the alleyways to the south and north. Far from expanding their field of fire, he could see no more than 20 yards out in each direction. Just listening to the shouted questions and commands on the radio, Howe sensed that some of those in charge were out of their depth. There was just too much going on. He could see it in their faces. Sensory overload. When it happened, you could almost see the fog pass over a man's eyes. They just withdrew. They became strictly reactive. Take the vaunted Rangers. Some of the Rangers were out there in the fight, but nobody was telling them what to do, and they sure as hell didn't know. Most of them were holed up in back rooms of the house one block south with their commander, Steele, waiting to see what was going to happen next. Howe figured there were more than 24 capable men and several heavy weapons back there in that house. What the hell were they doing? That was one thing he and Miller, and even the commanders overhead, seemed to agree on, at least.
Steele and his rangers needed to pick up their wounded and move 50 fucking yards down the slope to consolidate the perimeter and join the fucking fight. But Steele wouldn't budge. It was as if the rangers saw the D-boys as their big brothers, and since their big brothers were around, everything would be okay. Shooting quieted down after the moon came up. It cast faint shadows out on the street. The Little Bird gun runs lit up the sky with tracers and rockets. Brass from their miniguns rained down on the tin rooftops like somebody banging on the side of an empty metal bucket. There were bodies of Somalis still stretched out on the road. Howe noticed that the Sammies were good about hauling off their wounded and dead. Bodies tended not to stay put unless they were right in the middle of the street. Weapons, too. If there was a weapon down on the ground, it would be gone eventually, unless it was broken. They were smart street fighters. Howe felt a grudging professional admiration. They were disciplined, and what they lacked in sophisticated weapons and tactics, they made up for with determination. They used concealment very well. Usually, all you saw of a shooter was the barrel of his weapon and his head. Once darkness fell and the amateurs went home, the firing became less frequent, but more accurate. Shortly after moonrise, Howe was startled by loud voices from around the corner north of his doorway, over where Stebbins and Hurd had been hit. At first, he thought it was rangers. Who else would be dumb enough to be talking that loud out on the street? But the rangers were all supposed to be off the street. He popped an earplug and listened harder. The voices were speaking Somali. They must have been half deaf like everybody else from all the explosions and didn't realize how loud they were talking. Sometimes it took soldiers 2 or 3 days to regain full hearing after a fight. As 3 Somalis rounded the corner, one of the D-boys from across the street shone a white light on the first in line. His eyes looked as wide as a raccoon's, startled in a garbage can. With his rifle resting on a door jamb, Howe placed his tritium sight post on the second man and began shooting on full automatic, sweeping his fire in a smooth motion over the third man. All 3 Somalis went down hard. 2 of the men struggled to their feet and dragged the third man up and around the corner. Howe and the other operators let them go. They didn't want to expose their firing positions with more muzzle flashes. Howe was disgusted again with this 5.56 ammo. When he put people down, he wanted them to stay down. Chapter 10. When Steele and his men had first moved into the courtyard, it was bedlam. The noise was relentless. Shooting, grenade blasts, helicopter rotors, radio calls, men shouting, crying, groaning, screaming back and forth, trying to be heard over the din, each one's need more urgent than the next man's. There was smoke and gunpowder and dust in the air. Poor Lieutenant Lechner was bleeding a river from his shattered right leg and bellowing with pain. The courtyard itself was about 15 feet wide and maybe 18 feet long. There were 2 rooms to the right as you entered, 2 rooms to the left, and at the rear was a covered porch, walled off from the open middle with ornate concrete latticework. The first room to the left was filled, floor to ceiling, with tires. The first room on the right held the Somali family who lived here. They had been searched, flex-cuffed, and placed in the corner. Steele had 5 wounded men back behind the concrete partition. 2 of them, Goodale and Lechner, could no longer walk. Medics were still working on Lechner. Steele had 3 teams of D-boys mixed in with his force, none of whom answered to him, which further confused matters. At one point, the D-boys were talking about putting a heavy gun out on the street, just outside the courtyard doorway. They all carried rifles. Specialist Collette nervously listened to them discussing it. He was a saw gunner, and the only machine gunner who hadn't been injured. If anybody was going to be sent out there, it would be him. He'd spent more than an hour crouched behind a rock in the middle of Marahan Road, and now that he was finally safely indoors, going back out was the last thing he wanted. He'd do it, but he dreaded it. "I'm not sending anyone back outside," Steele told them. Colette heaved a quiet sigh of relief. Steele shouted back to his ranking sergeant, Sean Watson, to see if there were any back doors to this house. With all the shooting going on out front, he figured, when they left, it would be best to go out another way. Watson said there were no back doors. He could talk on the radio to his lieutenants, Perino and Di Tommaso, but he wasn't sure how far away either of them was. Di Tommaso spent a few minutes on the radio trying to orient the captain, but they had come in from different directions, and neither was familiar with the neighborhood, so the discussion got nowhere. Steele felt like he was playing the childhood game, where everyone is asked to turn their backs to the blackboard and draw a picture according to the teacher's instructions, the point of the game being how differently all the drawings turned out. In fact, Steele was no more than 50 yards away from Perino, who was separated from Di Tommaso by nothing more than an 8-inch flimsy interior wall. They might as well have been miles apart. Steele was desperate to get a fix on where all his men had gone, frightened that one or more had been left behind in the confusion. He'd lost track of Sergeant Eversman and Chalk Four completely. The last he knew, he had ordered them to head to the crash site on foot. He did not know that they had been picked up by the ground convoy and then gone through hell before returning to base, where they were now. Perino and Di Tommaso had given him a count on who was with them, and Perino had seen Rodriguez and Boren pulled into the casualty center across Marahan Road. But what of Stebbins and Hurd? Steele had no direct radio link to Captain Miller, so he relayed his requests for information to the C-2 bird, and they passed them along to Miller. "Kilo 6-4, Miller. This is Romeo 6-4, Harrell. He... Steele is requesting status on a Ranger Stebbins and a Ranger Hurd. He thinks they are with you. Can you confirm? Over." The C-2 bird reported back to Steele. "Roger, Juliet, the answer is affirmative. They have those two Rangers with them. Over." That was good news. But nobody seemed to know where Eversman's chalk had gone. Steele had just begun to contemplate a next move when Perino radioed him again about Smith. The captain knew it was hopeless to keep asking for another helicopter to come down, but he also knew he wasn't the one covered with Smith's blood, watching the young man's life ebb away. "I'm going to ask for it, but it's going to be pretty hard to put a bird in," Steele said. "I've got a big intersection right outside," said Perino. "They can put one down there." Steele called up on the command net. "Romeo 6-4, this is Juliet 6-4. We need medevac now. We have a critical who is not going to make it." Word came back down minutes later. "Roger, understand. We are pressing the QRF to get there as quickly as they can. I doubt that we can get a Hawk in there to get anybody out. Over." Medic Kurt Schmid had relayed a request for blood, getting Smith's type off his dog tags. After the resupply Black Hawk came and went, he approached Delta team leader Paul Howe. "Was there any blood?" "No," Howe told him. Schmid figured the blood supply must be stretched thin, dealing with all the casualties from the lost convoy. He had heard on the radio that the docs back at the base were drawing blood from donors to meet the sudden demand. He kept working on Smith, even though it now felt helpless. He had Perino and others in their courtyard taking turns pressing into Smith's lower abdomen to keep pressure over the femoral artery. The medic had finally relented and given Smith a morphine drip. It had quieted the corporal. He was still conscious, but just barely. He looked pale and distant. He had begun to make peace with dying. Perino could tell that even though Smith was now quiet and weak, he was still alert enough to be very scared. He talked about his family. His father had been a ranger in Vietnam and had lost a leg in combat. His younger brother Mike was planning to enlist and enter ranger school. Mike's twin, Matt, also wanted to join. Jamie had grown up wanting to be nothing else. He had played football and lacrosse in high school in northern New Jersey, and done well enough in his classes to graduate, which was good enough. He hadn't been interested in books or school. He knew what he wanted to be. Nothing could deter him, not even the scare his father, James Sr., had tried to put in him, speaking to him graphically about the horrors he had seen and experienced in Nam. 3 years earlier, when he was still in basic training, Smith had written to his father, "Today, while walking back from lunch, I saw two rangers walking through the company area. It's the dream of being one of those guys in faded fatigues and a black beret that keeps me going." Smith was now asking the medic to tell his parents and family goodbye, and to tell them that he had been thinking of them as he died, and that he loved them. They said prayers together. "Hold tight," Schmid told the dying corporal. "We're working on getting you out of here. I'm doing everything I can." Away from Smith, the medic kept telling Perino, "We need help. He's not going to make it." But how to convey the urgency with so much else going on? The resupply had delivered more IV fluids, and Schmid pumped those into Smith, but the kid had lost too much blood. He needed a doctor and a hospital. Even that may not have been enough to save him. He was just barely alive. When the moon came up, Steele kicked himself for letting the men leave behind their nods. Here he was, the inflexible by-the-book robot ranger tyrant, and he'd relaxed procedures this one time for what seemed like ample reason, and now they were in the fight of their lives at night, lacking the most significant technological advantage they had over the enemy. If ever there was a more perfect illustration of why not to ignore procedure. Still, it had seemed like such an obvious call that Sergeant Goodale had ridiculed Private Jeff Young back in the hangar for even asking about them as they had prepared to go out. "Young, think about it. What time is it?" "About 3 o'clock." "How long have our missions been?" "About 2 hours." "Is it still light out at 5?
"Yeah."
"Then why would you want to bring your night vision?" Steele was mortified by the stupidity of his call. In an hour or two, it was going to be darker than 4 inches up a goat's butt. He made a quick check around the courtyard to see if anybody, maybe just accidentally, had brought Nods along. No one had. Out the half-opened metal doorway, it now looked dark as a cavern. From where he stood in the second room at the north end of the courtyard, it appeared to be the kitchen. Steele could see moonlight reflecting blue off the barrels of his men's weapons sticking out of doorways. He called out to them one by one to make sure no one nodded off. Miller wasn't sure what was going on down the block. After he'd relayed the first request for Steele and his men to move up, Steele had declined an offer to speak directly to Miller via one of the D-Boys' headsets. From the Delta Command position, there was no telling what was wrong with Steele. There was some concern that the captain had been injured. The Ranger commander had broadcast that the command element had been hit, and nobody was sure if that meant him. Steele had been talking about Lechner. Miller had relayed a request for Steele to move at least some of his force down, if not across the intersection, then to the corner building on their block, where they could help cover the southern intersection. The Ranger commander had heard the urgings from the command helicopter, arguing that it would be easier for the Little Birds to do gun runs if the forces were in a tighter perimeter. The idea of stepping out of the relative safety of their fortified courtyard back into the street was hardly appealing. Nevertheless, when the C-2 bird made the initial request, Steele agreed. He radioed Perino and asked him to throw a blue chem light out his courtyard door into the street.
"Roger, it's out," said the lieutenant.
Steele then stepped briefly out into the street.
He was surprised how close the light was, only a short sprint up the road. He radioed back to Harrell,
"Okay, hua!"
Then he went back to tell Sergeant Watson to get ready for the move. Watson was blunt.
"Hey, sir, uh-uh," he said. "No way."
Watson said he thought the idea was crazy. They could expect a hail of bullets and grenades the second they stepped out the door. They had 5 wounded men, 2 of whom, Lechner and Goodale, would have to be carried. Fillmore's body would also have to be carried. To move quickly, that would mean 4 men for each litter, which would make convenient cluster targets for Somali gunmen. What was wrong with the position they had? The shooting had died down, and it would take one hell of a lot to overrun that courtyard. If they stayed where they were, they had a bigger perimeter. Why move? The Rangers listened nervously to the discussion. To a man, they sided with Watson. Private Floyd thought Steele was nuts to even suggest moving. Goodale certainly didn't relish the thought of making such a trip on a litter. Moving was unnecessary and dangerous. It was asking for more trouble when they already had plenty. Steele took a deep breath and reconsidered.
"I think you're right," he told Watson.
He conferred with the D-boys in the courtyard briefly, then radioed Harrell.
"Right now, we're not going to be able to move, not with all these wounded."
This was frustrating news for Captain Miller. Nobody had clearly sorted out who was in charge on the ground. If some part of Steele's force moved just to the end of their block, they could better cover the wide alley that ran between them. Harrell refused to order Steele to make the move.
"If you stay separated, I cannot support you as well," Harrell told Steele. "You're the guy on the ground, and you have to make the call."
Steele had made his call, and that was that. When one of the operators again offered Steele his headset so the captain could confer directly with Miller, Steele waved him away. So there were effectively 2 separate forces pinned down now, and their commanders were not talking to each other. If Steele wouldn't budge, Miller would at least move his own men. As the D-boys prepared to leave, Steele was angry. If they moved out, it would more than half the number of able-bodied men at his position. He felt it didn't make sense, and regarded Miller's move as a kind of fuck you directed at him and his men. But he did nothing to stop it. The operators lined up in the courtyard. When the first group of 4 dashed out into the night, the whole neighborhood erupted. It sounded like the city of Mogadishu had sprung viciously back to life. Within seconds, all 4 of the D-boys came flying back into the courtyard, tripping over the same metal rim at the bottom of the door that had tripped Steele up early in the afternoon. They wound up in a heap on the ground, their gun barrels clinking together as they untangled. Relieved that none had been injured, Steele watched them regroup with sober satisfaction.
"Hey, Captain, we've got to get Smith out. He's getting worse,"
came another radio call from Perino.
"Roger,"
Steele said. He knew it was hopeless, but he felt he had a responsibility to Smith to at least try. He tried the command net once more. He called up to Harrell.
"Romeo 6-4, this is Juliet 6-4. Our guy is fading fast. There's a wide intersection suitable for LZ,
landing zone,
directly outside. Can you mark it, Juliet? Is it big enough to bring in a hawk?"
Steele said it was, and that they could mark it. He waited a few moments for a decision. He could hear the frustration in Harrell's voice when it returned.
"We put a hawk in there to resupply, and it got shot so bad the bird is unusable. I think if we try to bring another MH-60,
a Black Hawk,
we are just going to have another bird go down on the ground. Over."
"This is Juliet 6-4.
Roger.
What is the ETA on the armored vehicles?"
There was no answer for a few minutes. Steele called back, knowing he was pushing.
"Romeo, this is Juliet."
"Go ahead, Juliet."
"Roger, you have an ETA for me?"
"I am working on it now. Stand by."
Harold's irritation showed.
Steele then heard Harrell pleading with the JOC. "We've got two critical packs." Carlos Rodriguez was also in critical condition. "That are going to die if we do not get them out of that location. I don't think that it is secure enough to bring in a bird. Can you get an ETA for the ground reaction force? Over." Then, minutes later, "If the QRF does not get there soon, there will be more KIAs, killed in action, from previously received WIAs, wounded in action. Get the one star, Brigadier General Greg Gile, commander of the 10th Mountain Division, to get his people moving." From the commander's perspective, other than the plight of Smith and Rodriguez, it made little sense to rush back out into the fray. Given the roadblocks and ambushes that had turned back the earlier convoys, the commanders were not taking any chances with the next one. They were going back out in major force, with hundreds of men led by Pakistani tanks and Malaysian armored personnel carriers. But it was taking time to assemble and organize this force. Harrell was told it would be at least an hour. It would actually take 3 hours before they were ready to move. Harrell reported back, "It is going to be an hour before they get in there. I don't think they will be able to get there within an hour." Steele told him that an hour was too long. Air Commander Matthews explained, "Roger, I want to try to put a bird in, but I'm afraid if I do, that we are just going to lose another aircraft. Over." Nobody wanted to write off the two young soldiers. Back at the JOC, the generals again considered landing a helicopter to take out Smith and Rodriguez. The pilots were ready to attempt it. Miller and Steele were asked again if they could adequately secure a landing zone to get a Blackhawk in and out. Perino walked out and consulted with Sergeant Howe, who told him a chopper could get in, but it damn sure wouldn't get back out. Captain Miller's Delta command post was consulted. He answered, "We are willing to try and secure a site, but there are RPGs all over the place. Is it going to be really hard to get a bird in there and get it out? I'm afraid that we are just going to lose another bird." Harrell delivered the reluctant verdict. "We are going to have to hold on the best we can with those casualties and hope the ground reaction force gets there on time." Steele sadly passed this word to Perino. "It's just too hot," Steele told him. Not long afterward, Smith started hyperventilating, and then his heart stopped. Medic Schmid went into full emergency mode. He tried CPR for several rotations, compressions and ventilations. Then he injected drugs straight into the Ranger's heart. It was no use. He was gone. Harrell was still pushing hard for the ground rescue force. "We've got guys that are going to die if we don't get them out of there, and I can't get a bird in. Over." It was at about 8 o'clock when Steele got another radio call from Perino. "Don't worry about the medevac, sir. It's too late." Steele put out the news on the command net. "One of the critical WIAs has just been KIA." Medic Schmid was shattered by Smith's death. The corporal had gone from a fully alert, strong ranger complaining, "I'm hurt," to a dead man in the medic's hands. Schmid was the chief medic at his location, so he had other men to attend to and no time to brood. But Smith's prolonged agony and death would haunt him for years afterward. Still covered with Smith's blood, he went to work on the others. He felt drained, terribly frustrated, and defeated. Was it his fault? Should he have found someone and tried to set up a direct transfusion early on, back when he expected rescue was imminent? He went back over every step he had taken in treating Smith's wound, second-guessing himself, blaming himself for every decision that had turned out wrong and had wasted time. Finally, he did his best to make peace with it. Schmid believed if he could have gotten Smith back to the base, his life would have been saved. He wasn't certain of it, but that was his gut feeling. Steele, too, was shaken by news of Smith's death. He knew nothing yet of Pilla, nor of any of his men who had taken off with the lost convoy and been killed. Kavako, Kovaleski, and Joyce. He'd seen Fillmore shot dead, but Smith was one of his own. He'd never lost a man before. Steele thought of them as his men, not the armies or the regiments, his. They were his responsibility to train and lead and keep alive. Now he was going to be sending one of them home, somebody's precious young son, in a flag-draped coffin. He walked back to quietly tell Sergeant Watson. They decided not to tell the other guys yet. Goodale was in high spirits for somebody with a second hole through his ass. He showed off his canteen with a bullet hole through it. He felt no pain from that round that had passed through his thigh and left a nasty wound on his right buttock. It wasn't very dignified. When Floyd had come huffing in after all the men had been waved into the courtyard from the street, he took one look at the medic stuffing Curlex up Goodale's exit wound and said, "You like taking it up the ass, huh, Goodale?" In the same back room was Errico, a machine gunner who had been wounded in both biceps manning his gun, and Nethery, who had been wounded in the upper arm when he took over for Errico. Nethery was distressed. The bullet had damaged both bicep and tricep, and he couldn't make his right arm work at all. One of the wounded men was crying, starting to freak out. "We're going to die here," he kept repeating. "We're never going home." "Just shut the fuck up," said Sergeant Randy Ramaglia. The man fell silent. Worst off was Lechner, who was now on a morphine drip. When Sergeant Ramaglia first came in the dark back room, he flopped down into what felt like a warm puddle. Then he realized it was Lechner's blood. The room smelled of blood, a strong, musky stink with a faint metallic tinge, like copper, an odor none of them would forget. Watson came back at one point, looking for more ammunition. They were down to about half of the supply they'd carried in. "I have some flashbangs if you want 'em," said Goodale. "No, Goodale, I don't want flashbangs," he said with gentle scorn. "We're not scaring them anymore. We're going to kill them now." Like the rest of the guys, Goodale was frustrated with how long it was taking the rescue convoy to come. He'd ask Steele for an ETA. The captain would give him one. Then that time would pass, and Goodale would ask again. Steele would give him a new time. Then that one would pass. "Atwater," he shouted out to Steele's radio man. "Look, I promised my fiancée I'd call her back tonight, and if I don't, I'm really going to be in some deep shit, so we've got to get out of here." Atwater just gave him a pained grin. "Hey, you motherfuckers, better all quiet down in there," came the voice of one of the D-boys. "All it takes is one RPG through that back window, and you're all fucked." Word whispered around about Smith. "Corporal Smith? What happened to Smith?" asked Goodale. "He's dead." The news hit Goodale hard. He and Smith were close. Both were smart-alecky, wise-ass guys, always ready with a stinger. But Smith was the best. He always kept the guys laughing. Just before they got called up for this thing, Smith had confided in Goodale. "I've got this girl. I think I'm going to marry her." They'd had a detailed discussion about ring buying, something Goodale had just gone through for Kira. Smith's decision to pop the question had brought them closer. It had moved them to a more serious level of manhood than the swaggering young coxmen around them. They'd spent a lot of time together in the hangar, playing Risk, or just shooting the shit. Smitty was dead? Private George Siegler guarded the Somalis who they had found in the house. They had been herded into the back corner room, a bedroom. There was a bed and a night table. The baby-faced soldier, who looked no older than 15, trained his M16 on the 2 women, a man, and 4 children. The adults were all on their knees. The youngest of them, a hugely pregnant woman, was crying. The others had been flex-cuffed, but not this woman, who couldn't hold the baby with her hands tied. She kept indicating with her hands that she was thirsty, so Siegler gave her his canteen. The children were all crying at first. The older ones looked to be between 6 and 10. One was an infant. In time, the children stopped crying. So did the pregnant woman after he gave her water. They couldn't communicate, but Siegler hoped she understood they meant her no harm. It got quieter and quieter as the night wore on. So long as they showed no light, there was no shooting into the courtyard. Earlier, bullets had been coming through the open door and popping great divots in the concrete latticework in back. But now that had stopped. Specialist Kurth relieved Siegler of the prisoners after a few hours. He sat sweat-soaked and thirsty. Earlier, when they'd taken off on the mission, Kurth had felt like taking a leak, but didn't, figuring they'd be back inside of an hour or so. He had ended up laying on his side out in the road behind the tin shack, urinating while gunfire snapped and popped around him, thinking, "This is what I get." This whole terrifying experience was having an effect on Kurth that he didn't fully understand. When he had been out on the street, crouched behind a rock that was nowhere near big enough to provide him cover, he'd thought about a lot of things. His first thought was to get the hell out of the army. Then, pondering it more as bullets snapped over his head and kicked up clods of dirt around him, he reconsidered. "I can't get out of the army. Where else am I going to get to do something like this?" And right there, in that moment, he decided to re-enlist for another 4 years. It grew quieter every hour as the night wore on. They kept getting situation reports, sit reps, from the Air Force guy up the street monitoring the various radio nets. The convoy was just a half hour away. Then, 45 minutes later, the convoy's an hour away. You could hear ferocious shooting off in the distance as the rescue force finally moved out. Kurth was cotton-mouthed. They all were terribly thirsty. The taste of dust and gunpowder was in their mouths, and their tongues were sticky and thick. Nothing in this world would taste as sweet as a cold bottle of water. Every once in a while, a little bird would come roaring in low, and there would be a frenzy of shooting and loud explosions, and the brass from the bird's gun would clatter off the tin roof and rain into the courtyard. Then it would get so quiet again, Kurth could hear himself breathing and the steady, hurried beat of his heart. Chapter 11. Specialist Waddell never actually got to go indoors with the rest of the men. When darkness came and everyone moved inside, Lieutenant DiTommaso told him to pull security at the west side of the hole that had been made by the falling Black Hawk. From where he lay behind some rubble, Waddell was looking out beyond the chopper's bent tail boom. Sergeant Barton curled up at the other side of the hole, pointing his weapon east, past the front of the bird. Earlier in the afternoon, Waddell had been terrified they wouldn't get out before dark. But by dusk, he was rooting for the sun to finish going down. It seemed to take forever. He figured once it was dark, the shooting would die down and they could breathe easier. He watched the little birds scream in, doing gun runs on the alley west, showering him with brass casings. Their rockets literally shook the ground. They made a sound like a giant piece of Velcro ripping open, and then there would be the flash and tremendous blast. The fact that it was so close felt good. That's where he wanted them. Close. One of the D-boys stripped down and climbed back into the helicopter and fished out some extra saw ammunition for Waddell and Barton and found a pair of nods, which Waddell got. With the night vision on, he could see all the way out past the big intersection west and use the laser aiming device, which gave him a much better feeling. The little green Fiat that had so ably served as cover across the intersection for Nelson, Barton, Urich, and Twombly was shot full of holes. Waddell could hear the radio keep promising to send out the rescue column. They were going to be there in 20 minutes. Then, an hour later, in 40 minutes. After a while, it got to be a joke. "They're on their way," guys would say, and laugh. When the big column did start to move across the city about a half hour before midnight, with its tanks and armored personnel carriers, trucks and Humvees, he could hear them miles away.
The convoy must have either been in terrific fighting or was basically lighting up everything in their path, because Waddell could track its movements by the sound of gunfire and by the way the sky lit up over it. He didn't think about the danger or the chances of being overrun and killed. He thought about stupid things. He was scheduled to take a physical fitness test the next day and wondered if, when they got back, they'd still make him take it. He asked Barton, "Hey, Sergeant, am I going to have to take a PT test tomorrow?" Barton just shook his head. Waddell thought about the Grisham novel he'd been reading before they left. He couldn't wait to finish that book. Wouldn't it be just his luck to get killed and never finish the last few pages? Every 30 minutes or so during the night, Barton would call over quietly, "You okay?" If Waddell hadn't heard from him in a while, he'd call over to him, "Sergeant, you okay?" Like either of them was going to go to sleep. Toward the middle of the night, the shooting stopped, and during certain stretches, the little birds weren't making runs, and it got very still. That's when he could hear the relief column off in the distance. Waddell was one of the few rangers who had actually brought a canteen full of water with him, instead of stuffing his pouch with ammo. So he handed over his canteen, and it was passed around greedily. "When are we gonna get the fuck out of here?" That was what Specialist Phipps wanted to know. He was in a small, smoky, dusty back room with the rest of the wounded, in the building adjacent to the crashed helicopter, his back and his right calf aching from shrapnel wounds, listening to the sounds of shooting and blasts outside, wondering when some wild-eyed Sammy was going to bust in and blow him away. He had no idea what was going on. Specialist Greg Gould was in there with him. Gould had taken some shrapnel to his butt, so he looked pretty ridiculous with his bandaged ass stuck up in the air, talking on and on about his girlfriend and how much he missed her and how he couldn't wait to see her again when he got home, all of which further depressed Phipps, who had no girlfriend. "Everything's gonna be cool. Man, when we get out of here, I'm gonna drink me some beer," Phipps said, trying to move Gould off the topic. It didn't work. Specialist Nick Struzik was in there. He'd been shot in the right shoulder. Phipps had seen him bleeding up against the stone wall outside earlier, not long before he'd been hit, and remembered being shocked by it, as though somebody had slapped him. Struzik was the first of his buddies he saw injured. Staff Sergeant Mike Collins was in really bad shape. He'd gotten tagged with a round in his right leg that had shattered both fibula and tibia. The bullet had entered just below the kneecap and come out the backside of his leg, mangling it. Collins was in some serious pain and had bled a lot. Phipps figured sadly that old Sergeant Collins probably wouldn't make it. He couldn't believe they'd all left their nods behind. The nods had always given them that cocky, we're-here-to-kick-ass feeling on previous night missions, because it's one hell of an advantage when you can see the motherfuckers and they can't see you. Talk about an awesome lesson learned. They all took sips from the IV bags because they were so thirsty, just to wet their mouths. It tasted slimy, but at least it was wet. Then, after the resupply bird came in, they all got a few sips of water. When it was clear they would be staying longer, Sergeant Lamb took Sergeant Ron Galliette with him and explored all the doors around the inner courtyard. Behind one door they kicked open were two women, one very old, and three babies. The younger woman wanted to leave. She was just a teenager, maybe 16, and looked too tiny and thin to have borne the baby she clutched so tightly. She wore a brilliant blue robe with gold trim. The baby was wrapped in the same colors. She kept moving toward the door. Lamb told Sergeant Urich to keep watch on her. Every time Urich looked away, she would move to the door again. He would hold up his rifle, and she would sit back down. Urich tried to talk to her. "Look, if we were going to do anything to hurt you, we would have done it by now, so just calm down," he said. But it was clear that she understood not a word. Urich talked to her anyway. He told her that she was far safer for the time being indoors than out. All she had to do was sit tight.
As soon as they could leave, they'd be gone. When she made another move to the door, he used his rifle to push her back into the corner.
"No, no, no. You need to stay here," he said, trying to frighten her into staying put.
The woman argued back with him with words he didn't understand. There was a spigot on the wall with the top broken off, and water was dripping steadily from it. Yurik collected some in his dry canteen and handed it to her. She turned her head and refused to take it from him.
"Be that way," he said.
Lam counted 15 wounded, along with the body of Super 6-1 co-pilot Donovan Briley. They needed more space, so they placed a small charge on a wall in the back. The stone and mortar were so flimsy that most walls you could just push down, so this charge blew a nice big hole about 4 feet high and 2 feet wide. It scared everyone when it went off, particularly the Somali woman Yurik was guarding. She went apoplectic. It even scared Twombly, who'd set the thing. He thought he had a 30-second fuse on the charge, and it was only 20 seconds, so he'd jumped a foot when it blew. The new hole opened into the room off the block's central courtyard where Perino had originally been. So Di Tommaso's unit and Perino's had finally, inadvertently, linked up. The shock of the explosion sent more of the outside wall tumbling down on Waddell and Barton out by the crashed helicopter. Nelson was so deaf he didn't even hear the blast. His ears just rang constantly ever since Twombly had fired his saw right in his face. Nelson surveyed the carnage around him and felt wildly, implausibly lucky. How could he not have been hit? It was hard to describe how he felt. It was like an epiphany. Close to death, he had never felt so completely alive. There had been split seconds in his life when he'd felt death brush past, like when another fast-moving car veered from around a sharp curve and just missed hitting him head-on. On this day, he had lived with that feeling, with death breathing right in his face, like the hot wind from a grenade across the street, from moment after moment after moment, for 3 hours or more. The only thing he could compare it to was the feeling he found sometimes when he surfed, when he was inside the tube of a big wave, and everything around him was energy and motion, and he was being carried along by some terrific force, and all he could do was focus intently on holding his balance, riding it out. Surfers called it the Green Room. Combat was another door to that room, a state of complete mental and physical awareness. In those hours on the street, he had not been Sean Nelson. He had no connection to the larger world, no bills to pay, no emotional ties, nothing. He had just been a human being, staying alive from one nanosecond to the next, drawing one breath after another, fully aware that each one might be his last. He felt he would never be the same. He had always known he would die someday, the way anybody knows that they will die, but now its truth had branded him. And it wasn't a frightening or morbid thing. It felt more like a comfort. It made him feel more alive. He felt no remorse about the people he had shot and killed on the street. They had been trying to kill him. He was glad he was alive, and they were dead. When they moved the wounded into the bigger room cleared out by Twombly's charge, Sergeant Collins had to be passed through the hole on a stretcher. To get him through, they had to strap him down and tilt the stretcher sideways. Collins protested as they readied him for this move.
"Guys, I got a broken leg."
"I'm sorry," Lam told him. "We've got to get you through." Collins screamed with pain as they passed him to the men on the other side. They moved the body of Bull Briley back on a litter. Nelson had seen Briley playing cards and laughing in the hangar earlier that day. His head had been cut open in the crash, sliced from ear to ear, just beneath his chin. His body was still warm and sweaty, but it had turned a sickly gray. The slit through his head was an inch wide and had stopped bleeding. When they lifted his short, thick body on the litter, the top of his head flopped back grotesquely. Lam remembered seeing him running, wearing spandex shorts, a powerful man. Jesus, this is a sad day. When they'd worked him through the hole, Lamb climbed through and pulled Briley's body off the litter and put it up against the wall. The pilot's head hit the wall with a mushy thud that sickened Lamb. He flattened him out so that when rigor set in, the body would not be folded at the waist. Abdiaziz Ali Aden waited in darkness. The rangers moved through his house. Through the small opening the helicopter had smashed in the roof, he could see stars. The rangers had hung red lamps out on the trees and on top of the houses. He had never seen lights like these. Gunfire was still loud out in the streets, coming from all directions. Helicopters swooped down low and rattled the rooftop with their falling shells. He could hear the Americans inside talking to the helicopters on their radios, directing their fire. He wasn't sure which was more dangerous, to stay in the house with all of the rangers on the other side of the wall, or to risk being shot running away through the night. He debated until the sound of the shooting died off and decided to leave. He pulled himself up to the top of an outer wall and jumped down to the alley. There were 4 people dead where he landed, 2 men, a woman, and a child. He ran and had only gone a short distance when a helicopter came roaring down behind him and bullets kicked up the dirt and bounced off the walls. He kept his head down and kept on running and was surprised he was not hit. Tim Wilkinson, the PJ, watched over the wounded men off Captain Miller's courtyard across Marahan Road. Wilkinson sat in the doorway to the yard with a handgun. There were only occasional pops of gunfire. Now and then, a little bird would come roaring down and light up the sky out the window. Stebbins lit a match for a cigarette, and Wilkinson, startled, wheeled around with his handgun.
"Just lighting a butt, Sergeant."
There was a moment of silence. Then both men grinned, thinking the same thought.
I know," said Stebbins. "It could be hazardous to my health, right?"
Chapter 12. Late in the night, Norm Hooten and the other D-boys, teams led by Sergeants First Class John Boswell and John Hale, along with a crew of rangers headed by Sergeant Watson, left Captain Steele's southernmost courtyard and ducked into the narrow alley against its north wall, where Fillmore's body had been placed late in the afternoon. They had decided things were quiet enough for them to move, as Captain Miller had wanted, into the corner building at the north end of their block. From there, they could cover the wide east-west alleyway that separated the 2 pinned-down forces. The move left Steele in the courtyard with the wounded and only 4 or 5 able-bodied men, but the others weren't going far. None of the rangers was eager to go. One, a sergeant, flat out refused to leave the courtyard, even after Steele issued him a direct order. The man had just withdrawn. He protested something had scratched his eye. He was told to just get back and help with the wounded. Sergeants Thomas and Watson followed the D-boys out into the night, trailed by Floyd, Kurth, Colette, and several other men. Floyd found a dead donkey on the side of the street, just outside the door, and crouched down behind it. The D-boys had gone up the alleyway and climbed into the corner building through a window that was only about 3 feet from the ground. By the time Floyd entered the alley, they had moved Fillmore's body in through the window. Floyd tripped over something. He fell down and found Fillmore's Car 15. The dried blood on it flaked off in his hands. He also found Fillmore's helmet with its headset radio and some of his other gear. He was gathering it up when Watson leaned out the window.
"What the fuck are you doing, Floyd? Quit playing. Get your ass through this window."
Floyd had a hard time climbing through carrying all that gear. Watson gave him a pull, and he landed in a space much larger than the one where Captain Steele and the others were. Fillmore's body was laid out in the middle, in the moonlight. The D-boys had flex-cuffed the dead operator's arms down by his sides and his feet together to make him easier to carry. Across the alley from the window they had entered was another on the wall that divided them from the wounded next door. They smashed the shutters so they could more easily talk back and forth.
The D-boys set infrared strobes around the new space to mark it for the helicopters. Floyd searched the courtyard and found a full 55-gallon drum under a dripping spigot. He sniffed at it first to see if it was gasoline. Then he stuck his finger in and licked it. It was water. Kurth and the rest of the men had been sternly warned about drinking the local water. "Nothing will make you sicker quicker," the docs had said. Well, Kurth decided, to hell with the docs. If he got sick, fine, he'd deal with that later. He filled his canteen and swallowed just enough to wet his throat. Then he and Sergeant Ramaglia, who was in the room across the alley, began passing canteens back and forth on a broomstick. Ramaglia rounded up all the empties he could find, passing the stick through the holder on the plastic cap that screwed on the top of the canteen. One by one, Floyd filled the canteens from the big drum. Then he and Colette sat for a long time and talked in whispers. The D-boys had all the windows and doorways covered, so there was nothing for them to do. The moon was up, casting soft light over Fillmore's body in the middle of the courtyard. Colette kept checking his watch. Floyd poked around the courtyard, his pants flapping open around his bare middle. On the ground, next to his boot, he found a brand new dust case for an M16.
"Hey, Colette, look at this here."
They'd been told all the Sammies had were beat-up old weapons. This one still had the packing grease on it. Colette was feeling bored. He couldn't believe it. Bored in a combat zone? How could that happen? The whole scene was weird, too weird for belief. Nobody would ever believe this shit back home. They listened to the gun runs overhead and to the approaching roar of weaponry as the giant rescue convoy fought its way in.
"Hey, Floyd."
"Yeah?"
"I've got an idea."
"What?"
"Want to get a combat jack?"
Floyd couldn't believe his ears. Colette was suggesting they both beat off. This was a running joke with the Rangers, getting a jack in exotic places. Guys would brag about getting a Thailand jack, or an Egypt jack, or a C-5 jack. They both laughed.
"Colette, you're fucking high, man. You're crazier than hell," Floyd said. "No, man, think about it. You would definitely be the first kid on your block. How many people can say they got one of those, huh?"
Chapter 13. From overhead, the commanders watched the contested neighborhood through infrared and heat-sensitive cameras that sketched the blocks in monochrome. They could see crowds of Somalis moving around the perimeter in groups of a dozen or more and kept hitting at them with helicopters. Aidid's militia was trucking in fighters from other parts of the city. The little birds made wall-rattling gun runs throughout the night. One of the birds shot at a Somali carrying an RPG, who must have been toting extra rounds on his back. They placed a 17-pound rocket on him, which killed him, and must have blown the extra rounds, because he went up like a Roman candle. When the chopper went back to refuel, they found pieces of the man's body pancaked on their windshield. Sergeant Goodale, lying with his wounded butt cheek off the ground, had resumed the job of coordinating gun runs from inside Captain Steele's courtyard. He couldn't see anything from where he sat, but he acted as a clearinghouse for all the other radio operators calling in fire. He decided which location needed the help most and relayed it up to the command bird. Late in the evening, he got word that two very large forces of Somalis were moving from south to north. For the first time, Steele felt a stab of panic. Maybe we're not going to make it out of here. If a determined Somali force stormed the entrance to the courtyard, he and his men would kill a lot of them, but probably couldn't stop them. He moved around, making sure all of his men were awake and ready. He was kicking himself now for having let his men rope in without carrying bayonets, another item called for in the tactical standing procedures, but which they had jettisoned to save weight. Who would have thought they'd need bayonets? Steele poked his head in the back room, where Goodale was with the rest of the wounded, and informed him with grim humor.
If you see somebody coming through this doorway and they're not yelling, "Ranger, Ranger," you go ahead and shoot them, because we're all out here dead. Goodale was shocked. The quiet had lulled him into a false sense of safety. He reasoned with himself. Okay, I might die here. I'd rather not. But if I do, then that's what's supposed to happen, and there's not a damn thing I can do about it. And he thought about what a terrible thing it was to have turned over responsibility for his life, his very